This episode is brought to you in part by Brew Guru, the free mobile app that helps you save money on beer and home brewing supplies. Find Brew Guru in your preferred app store and follow the path to good beer. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 3rd, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, homebrewer Ryan Deaver tells us about Chukatu, a West African sorghum beer that Ryan discovered while living in the country of Benin. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com. And we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter, including early releases of our video shows and behind-the-scenes videos that the general public will never get to see. I'm planning to do an early release for subscribers by the end of this week of the video episode that Steve and I shot revisiting my Brett Golden Ale that I brewed way back in March. It's hard to believe, but it's been 6 months since I pitched Brettanomyces at bottling with that beer. Steve and I compare a bottle that had no Brett against one that did. Very tasty and interesting results. The Brettanomyces that I pitched at bottling time was Suburban Brett from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. And speaking of which, the current seasonal release from Imperial is A40 Bubbles. This is Imperial's first cider strain, as well as their first foray into gluten-free production. A traditional cider strain, Bubbles is a beautiful strain for fruit juice-based fermentations. Casey at Imperial says the clean profile of the yeast, especially when used at the lower end of the temperature range, allows the nuances of the fruit to be prominent in the finished bubbly beverage. This strain is produced on Imperial's 100% gluten-free media, so good news for the gluten-free folks out there. I'm excited about A40 Bubbles from Imperial, and I went out and bought 2 gallons of organic pasteurized apple juice to use with it. And since Imperial yeast is organic, I guess this will be my first organic cider. I need to find some organic sugar to prime it with, or I might just stick with just leaving it still. Haven't decided yet. Get with your homebrew store and ask for A40 Bubbles from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Matthew from Katy, Texas writes, I just listened to the distilling podcast and heard the email about the chocolate banana stout and your questions about using Hefeweizen yeast to bring out the banana character. I can attest that I attempted to brew an Imperial banana split stout with some success last year. Matthew says, my goal was to capture the flavors of chocolate, banana, coconut, and roasted nuttiness in a beer. To attempt to achieve this goal, I devised a recipe of the following ingredients: malted wheat, perla negra roasted barley, dehusked, that's 15% of the malt bill, biscuit malt for 5% of the malt bill, enough rice hulls to finally get it to lauter. I guess if the rest of it's going to be malted wheat, you're going to need that. Sabro bittering and flavor hops for coconut flavors. Powdered peanut butter, that's PB2, added at Whirlpool and in the secondary, and fermented with White Labs WLP-300. Matthew says, I entered this beer in the Blue Bonnet Brew Off in Dallas in February of this year and scored a 40 in the experimental beer category. What I can say about this recipe is that it was exceptionally viscous, with some of our Cane Island Ailers homebrewing club members saying it was like chewing on beer. Matthew says, while I did hit some of the notes I was looking for, I thought that the roasty dark chocolate flavors completely dominated the banana flavors of the yeast. The biscuit malt and PB2 nuttiness that was going on or that I was going for was also difficult to ascertain with a high degree of roastiness. Matthew says, my lessons are that you really need to find the right balance of roast malts to let the other flavors you're trying to bring out emerge. Also, if you're going to imperialize this beer and use Hefeweizen yeasts, underpitching the yeast to produce esters can lead to a very under-attenuated beer. Perhaps a co-pitch with a higher attenuator on day three or so of active fermentation might help achieve the desired attenuation levels. Good advice. Thanks, Matthew. Sounds like a fun and tasty beer. Every time I see that powdered peanut butter in the store, I want to reach for it and throw it in a beer. So maybe next time I see it on the shelf, I'll do that. Hey, it's still hot here in Northwest Arkansas, but they say fall weather may finally be on the way later on this week, maybe. That's brewing season coming up. It's time to step up your game with an electric brewing system from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. High Gravity's been building electric brewing systems for more than a decade, so they know what they're doing. Their Warthog controllers are robust enough to work in home and commercial settings. In fact, they brew with one at Pippin's Tap Room, which is a part of High Gravity. And did you know that if you go to highgravitybrew.com, you can find electric solutions from other manufacturers as well? Dave says the new controllers from Blickman, for example, are a great value and can scale up with your needs. And there are high-gravity Warthog controllers that can scale up as well. Whether it's 5 gallons or 2 barrels, a single vessel like mine, or one of the more traditional 2 or 3 vessel configurations, highgravitybrew.com is the place to go. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric brewing purchase. Take the pain out of propane at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. The previous time we talked to Ryan Deaver, he was in Benin in Western Africa, and we talked about palm wine. Well, Ryan's back in the United States now and is yet another member of the D.C. homebrewing community that's been on the show. This time, Ryan tells us of a very local, very fresh beer made from sorghum. Ryan Deaver, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Oh, thank you.
And welcome back to the United States.
Yeah, it's been about a year, but it's still transitioning back to life back home.
Now, last time we talked about palm wine, and you were actually still over in Africa, in Benin, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. And I guess I had just arrived there. I'd been there for a few months, but I ended up spending 2 years there total.
Wow. And you were kind of cautious about talking about what you were doing over there, but now that you're back home, you're in the D.C. area now. You can talk about what you were doing back there.
Yeah, so I think at the time I just said that I was a volunteer working in development, but I was a Peace Corps volunteer over there working in the agriculture sector primarily. Awesome. I mean, we did a lot of other stuff, but I just couldn't talk too much about it just for security reasons, but. Now I can, so.
Sure. Well, thank you for your service. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. It was a good time. It was a real privilege.
Well, it's good that the Peace Corps is still out there and I hope doing good things.
Yeah, I mean, Benin has had a program for half a century anyway. So, I think uninterrupted. So it's still going strong.
Good. Well, we don't want to. We're swerving dangerously close to talking politics here, and we don't want to do that here at Basic Brewing Radio. We want to talk about beer, yeah. And you brought to my attention that you had written an article for Craft Beer and Brewing magazine about a sorghum beverage that was made there or is being made there in Benin, and I'm going to let you mm-hmm. take the first stab at pronouncing it.
Yeah, so. You know, shorthand folks over there just call it chuk, but the whole word is chukutu. It's a word from there are a couple of different language families over there in the northwestern part of Benin, but it comes from an Odamari or a Didamari word. It's just I don't think it necessarily means anything. It's just the name of the beer. So
it's a sound that you make after you've had a few.
Yeah.
Now, the article is very well written, and it's almost like a travel log. And you really painted a picture of the sort of area where this beverage is consumed, and also of the kind of culture that surrounds it. So, can you talk about first of all, before we talk about what chook is, talk about where it's consumed.
Sure. So it's a beverage that's, you know, I'm sure that there are a lot of, you know, tribes in the region, a lot of ethnic groups in the region that say, oh, we were the first to do it. No, we were the first to do it. But being in Benin and being around, you know, a lot of Beninese people, they said, well, we were the first to do it. And so there are a couple of tribes up in the northwestern part of Benin, and like really far northwest, up on the border with Togo and Burkina Faso. And it's just beautiful up there. It's, you know, Benin is about the size of Pennsylvania in terms of area and roughly the shape of it. It's a pretty small country by African standards. But it's so close to the equator that the you know, you get a really wide spread of topology and, you know, climate zones. So down in the south, it's really, really tropical. You got a lot of palm trees, a lot of fruit trees, a lot of hard red clay. And I guess that's why, you know, we were talking about palm wine last time, is because it's a lot of palm trees down in the south. Mm. But you go up north and things change pretty drastically, pretty quickly. And it's mountainous. It's a little more, it depends on the time of year, you know, it can be really lush. There's also like a 5-month dry season. So it's, you know, pretty intense up there, depending on what time of year it is, but it's just beautiful.
So I'm assuming is the grain, is the sorghum that they use in making chook, is it grown around there locally?
Yeah, and I mean, sorghum is a major crop in most of West Africa, and I believe all over the continent, just because it grows particularly well at higher temperatures. It's a lot more tolerant to the climate than most other cereal grains. But people do grow a lot of corn there as well, and they do, you know, add some corn to their beer occasionally. They also grow millet, which is really closely related to sorghum. But yeah, it's all pretty much local. A lot of people, you know, a lot of wealthier families will have, relatively wealthier families will have a swath of like farmland where they grow their sorghum, sell it, stock the grain, and then are also able to, you know, make beer on the side.
And you describe a culture of these drinking establishments that I think you call them cabarets, these little places.
Yeah, that's the word in the local French, you know, it would be a cabaret. Hmm. In, you know, I don't know what you would call it in France. I don't really speak French, but you might say like buvette or just like a bar. But yeah, locally it's a cabaret. And it could range from somebody's house. In this case, like in the article, the lady I hung out with, really nice lady. She became a good friend to several of the Peace Corps volunteers up there. She's got, you know, she's got the best beer in the region. A lot of people really, you know, hype her beer up, and for good reason. There's a lot of bad chukutu out there, and hers is exceptional. And anyway, she sells it out of her house. She's got like an outbuilding, that clay concrete room that's, you know, pretty nice. Whereas you go down to the market grounds, you go to other small villages and cities, and sometimes you might just sit around on some logs and a lady might come up with a plastic bucket full of beer and serve it to you. Other times you might sit in a tin hut. Yeah, it all just depends.
And the chukutu has kind of an interesting origin story.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that I don't want to paint it in such a way that it sounds like, oh, you know, this is some ancient technique, because I don't think it is. I think people have been doing this for a couple hundred years. in the region. But that story is kind of, it parallels sort of the origin story of beer and I think agriculture in general that you hear all the time. You know, somebody was growing cereal grains and was soaking them in water to try to soften them up to process them or to cook them down, and ended up accidentally malting it. And I think that's kind of the same story here. There's I had the guy that taught me French, basically, really nice guy. For the first 3 months I was in the country, he sat with me every day and taught me how to speak French. And he is a really interesting guy and happens to be really into local history. And so he told me this story about how there was this man, and he had a wife. And in Benin, a lot of different cultures in Benin, people practice polygamy. And this man was ready to take a second wife. And she was a young lady. And so she moved into the house. They got married. And she was helping the first wife process some of the year's grain harvest. And she let one of the bags get wet. And they germinated. And so she kind of freaked out and went to the first wife and said, "Well, what do we do? You know, this grain is shot." And the first wife said, "Well, you know, we'll take care of this." And they laid it out in the sun, dried it, and ground it up. And they made some meal with it. They made some porridge with it. And of course, you know, the leftovers started fermenting, and the rest is history. So,
yeah, that, you're right. That it parallels almost exactly the theory of how beer was discovered or first brewed. You know, somebody accidentally got the grain, you know, seed wet, and it sprouted, and they went ahead and used it anyway, and then wound up getting intoxicated at the end of it. So it's interesting that this, you know, kind of backs up that, you know, those stories.
I mean, and it makes sense. You know, the malted grain, beer wants to make itself, you know, the microbes want to get in there. They want to, you know, eat the sugar, and they're going to do it if they can. And it's bound to happen, I think.
So how do you get started? You get yourself some sorghum seed first, right?
Yeah, and a lot of folks who don't have the privilege of a plot of land, like really small-scale producers, you know, people who are doing this as a really small income-generating activity might buy it from the market. And there are a lot of varieties of sorghum locally available. I mean, there's sweet sorghum and, you know, hard sorghum and orange and red and white sorghum that people choose from, and everybody has a different opinion about it, but there are a handful of varieties that are prized for their you know, suitability for making beer. And so I think most people there probably are buying their grain in the market. They don't have the privilege of, you know, having their own field of sorghum. Mm-hmm. But some do. So you procure the sorghum, and there aren't really professional malt. I mean, I hesitate to say that. There are people there that definitely know how to malt the sorghum. But it's a fairly intensive process. It can get away from you in the tropics, you know, so it's a lot of TLC, a lot of turning that grain, making sure it's not getting moldy, making sure that which I think is true of any malting process, but it's a lot harder in a climate where you don't have any control over the process. So, people just malt it at home. They'll have like a back closet or a shed or an outbuilding where they're just doing it right on the concrete. And then they'll dry it down, break off the shoots and grind it up into a flour. Some people do it by hand. Other people rent like gas-powered mills. So,
well, before we get away from the malting process, how familiar are you with the details of that? I mean, how long do they have to in traditional malting? You know, of barley, there's some steeping and drying phases, and then, you know, you move on to the germination phase, and, you know, so there's some various steps that we've heard about in that area. But for instance this woman that you became friends with, how formal is her malting process?
I mean, I would say she's pretty practiced. As far as how formal it is, I think there's a lot of room for her discretion. You know, I think for her, it's a lot of how even is the germination, how far have the grains germinated, and I don't know that there is necessarily a strict calendar. And the way I understood it is she soaks it once. It's a one and done kind of thing. Soaks the grain, lets it germinate, and when it's ready, that's when it gets dried.
So she just knows just by looking, probably, and she, you know, there may be some other things, taste, and you know, splitting some of the seeds open or something like that. But she's done it long enough that she knows how to do it.
Yeah, she's really good at it. So.
So for the, for those not familiar with the malting process, you, the reason that you do malting is that you let the seed grain sprout, essentially, or start to sprout, germinate, and then you stop that germination process because you want the enzymes that are created inside the seed, you know, during that germination to use in a mashing process that changes starches into sugars that the yeast can eat. So that's the the elevator pitch.
Yeah, and I will say that sorghum is not like in the, you know, as far as cereal grains go, as far as you know, grains with amylases with diastatic enzymes, it's not a rock star. It's not barley, but it'll do the trick. You know, it works. It just doesn't work as well as some of our you know, are really well modified grains.
Yeah, it's not six row, say. Row barley. So once she's got her malt, does she dry it, or does she go ahead and just use it in the brew?
Yeah, so she dries it. She has to she grinds it into a flour. And when I mean, it's really not like the crush isn't anything that resembles what you would use in beer and you know, a barley based beer. It's a pretty fine flour, but yeah, she has to dry it in order to grind that.
And this is a, would this be a, maybe I'm skipping ahead, but would this be a gluten-free product?
I think so. Yeah, actually, I've thought about this because I know that a lot of folks who are into the gluten-free brewing supplement, or you know, light gluten brewing, will supplement some of their base malt with sorghum, or they'll do 100% sorghum, which I haven't had a 100% sorghum beer to my knowledge, but I have had a few gluten-free beers, so maybe I have. I don't know.
So this, so I don't know. This may pique the interest of the of the gluten-free community out there, so, or the zero tolerance folks may be pricking up their ears. So talk about the mashing process. How, once she gets her flour, what's next?
So this was really interesting to me, and I want to make sure – I've thought a lot about this since I wrote that article, and I still don't have a great vocabulary for it because it's not like she has a mash slaughter ton. It's not like she has the mash and the boil. It's all kind of streamlined together. So she takes the grain – and I don't have the proportions off the top of my head, but she takes a good amount of grain and then considerably more water and soaks it in a clay pot. And mind you, this is like midday. It's around 11 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning. The sun is starting to pick up, and we're in sub-Saharan Africa, so it's pretty warm. And this grain steeps for half an hour sometimes, and basically just creates this tea, which is effectively the wort. Even though it doesn't go through a dedicated step mash or even like a dedicated single infusion, it's just it sits there, it leaches out into the water, and then she dumps it all into a pot, except for like a third of that wort. So she puts a portion of the wort off to the side to let it get lactic, to let the bacteria that are present on the grain do their thing. So it's like a lactic acid bacteria starter. It's like a sour mash almost. And anyway, she takes the other portion of the grain wort admixture, puts it over the fire, and as she feeds logs into the fire and as the fire gets stronger and stronger, it goes you know, it warms up and then it eventually boils. And as it boils, she lets a protein break forms. She works through that. And then once the protein break has dissipated, she pretty much filters off the grain from the wort. And then, she lets it chill. And once it gets to where you could put your hand in it, basically still hot, but not, you know, not piping hot, she'll reintroduce that bacteria-rich portion of the wort that she'd had off to the side and let it sour. And as soon as it sours, she boils it again, just like you would with like a kettle sour. And then she pitches in a Saccharomyces. I say Saccharomyces. She pitches in a yeast cake that has who knows what in it, probably a whole diverse spread of microbes, but primarily Saccharomyces, and it fires right up. I mean, within hours, you're drinking the stuff.
And this the yeast cake comes from a previous good batch, one would assume.
Yep, exactly.
Wow. So within 24 hours of starting the brewing process with the malt, obviously it's going to take a few days to get the grain malted, but within 24 hours of brewing the beer, you're drinking it?
Yeah. And it's easily within 24 hours, and it's good.
So what's it taste like?
So it's pretty thick, and it depends on who makes it and what their techniques are, but it's pretty chewy. For a lot of people, it's a source of carbohydrates. It's a staple in their diet, and it keeps people alive. You know, it's especially during the dry season. It's a way to drink to get some water. It's not a super strong alcoholic beverage, although you can imbibe too much. I have done it a few times, and it's delicious. It can range from really sweet, sweet and rich and thick, like a porridge with just a tiny little bit of acidity, to full-blown vinegar. Mm. And what you want is something in the middle. You know, you want something that, because it can take on these sort of orange zesty flavors. A little bit of vinegar is nice. It's a strong acidity. It's just like I can't compare it to anything else. It's just a porridge that tastes like you poured some Berliner Weiss into it or something.
Mm. And this stuff is still fermenting. It's still active.
Actively, yeah. And it's I will say you have to be careful not to drink too much of it, because it will continue to ferment as you're drinking it, and it's a pretty bad upset stomach.
Mm. I can imagine it could cause some gastrointestinal distress.
Very much so. But if you take it in moderation and blend some of the older beer back into the younger stuff, you mitigate some of that, and it tastes better that way too.
Well, you know, along with the origin story of beer, there's also the story that's, you know, told of people drinking beer over time, over the centuries, because, you know, it was used for nutrition and because it was safer to drink than water in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is that the case in Benin? Is it safer to drink this Chukutu than the local water?
Well, let's put it this way. The last time I talked to you, I was in the hospital with dysentery. I don't know if you remember, but so yes, it's definitely safer to drink the beer than it is to drink the water. It's boiled for one, and it's fermented. And honestly, the water infrastructure there is, it depends on the time of year. During the dry season, when watering holes are kind of limited, there are occasionally outbreaks of cholera. There's a large, diarrheal illnesses are the neck, I think, aside from malaria, are the number one cause of death under 5 years old there. So it's serious business. And a bottle of water there might cost, I don't know, $2 to a dollar to $2. And some of these folks are making $1 a day, $2 a day.
Wow.
And you could go pay 5 cents for a bowl of beer, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, we in the Western world, you know, diarrheal illness is painful sometimes and you know, disgusting and an inconvenience, but you know, we can go down to the drugstore or have someone go for us and you know, we could be okay within a day or two. But if you don't have the proper resources, it can be deadly.
Yeah, a lot of folks there just don't have the proper resources, especially in that region. Where this beer is being made, the city I was in, Ngadi Tingu, is one of the largest cities in that region. And people come from lots of really small villages from around the mountains. Some of them take motorcycles and ride in an hour just to go sell stuff at the market and buy basic goods at the market to take back to their villages.
Now, about what temperature is she pitching the yeast?
Gosh, I don't know. 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 90. It's still warm.
Yeah. And on the tip of my tongue, you know, at the front of my mind, you know, with all this talk about Kvik and fermenting at high temperatures, it seems like there may be some interesting microbes, you know, being used over in West Africa that, you know, other people may want to take a look at.
Yeah, and I will say that I should correct myself. If I'm correct, she was placing this, it was essentially like a trash can, a plastic tub where she had the beer fermenting, but she had put it off to the side in a shed. So you're talking 85 degrees, 90 degrees, but
yeah, still.
Yeah, that's hot. And it fired up really quickly, and I will say that it was surprisingly clean, aside from the rapid takeover of acetic acid bacteria. You know, the stuff turns to vinegar in a day, but when the Saccharomyces is doing its thing, it's remarkably clean.
And traditional yeast, if you ferment it, you know, like 90 degrees Fahrenheit or what is that, 32 Celsius, you know, you're going to get some nasty, you know, higher alcohol off flavors,
yeah.
You know, and it's not going to be pleasant to drink at all, theoretically.
Yeah, you're going to get a headache for sure.
Yeah.
It's not going to be pleasant. I've done it, you know. My early homebrew, for sure.
If the yeast is happy warm, it'll be happy even warmer. I want to make sure the yeast is happy.
Yeah, that was just a lack of temp control in the early days.
And that
was the last time I did that too.
Yeah, I actually did that with one of my early batches of mead. You know, it was wintertime and, you know, it wasn't going to, the fermentation wasn't going as well as I thought. And so I put it over the heating vent and, yeah, it kicked up the activity, but it has its bad effect.
It's not cheap and those higher alcohols aren't going anywhere. So,
yep.
It's a bummer to go and open a bottle a year into the aging and find out that it's garbage.
Yeah. Live and learn and share with the people you don't like as much. So are there any, I mean, you were talking about these being wood fires. Mm-hmm. Are there any, you know, negative effects of brewing a bunch of chukatu?
Yeah. And I alluded to that a little bit in that article. Deforestation is a huge problem in West Africa. It's bananas. It's a beautiful country, and it's got a lot of really interesting biogeographic phenomena. You know, stuff there. So it's in this region called the Dahomey Gap. Benin was the kingdom of Dahomey before the French decided to call it Benin.
Hmm.
In any case, it's this little pocket of West Africa where the air that comes down from the Sahara is just a little bit drier than in any of the neighboring countries. And so whereas in, you know, Guinea or parts of Nigeria, you might have full-blown tropical rainforest. In Benin, you have this sort of savanna where you've got more trees than you would see in like a traditional African savanna, but the canopy never closes. It's this, it's really unique, and it's something that's only found in that part of the world. And there's almost none of it left. And that's not really on the part, it's not the fault of local folks so much as previously European exploitation, and now you've got a lot of folks from China and India who are stepping in and driving that as well. But it doesn't help that, you know, a lot of very basic day-to-day functions, as well as making beer, depend on wood fires. So it's people have to travel really far just to get sticks to make beer, to cook food at home, to boil water. So it's a big problem.
Wow. We take our you know, electric brewing systems so much for granted here in the United States. Or our, you know, our propane, going down to the you know, the convenience store or whatever and getting another you know, tank of propane. It's I imagine you have had your eyes opened a lot as to, you know, how good we've got it being from, you know, being over there.
We're definitely spoiled on the homebrew front, but Benin is a very great place. You know, those things are all true about it, but it's also a very beautiful country with a lot of very great people. So,
well, excellent. What else are we missing? I don't know that. Do you know of anybody stateside or outside of the country that that have tried doing this process? You know, away from its native spot?
You know, I'm sure that in some communities where there have to be some West African enclaves. I know that there are a lot of folks from Cameroon, for example, in Nigeria, here in D.C. However, I don't think that this brewing tradition, at least with sorghum and in this particular way, is as widespread. I don't think it's common in Cameroon or Nigeria. I will say in South Africa, they have a similar beer, and the name escapes me right now. But as far as stateside, as far as sort of off the African continent, I don't know. I've thought about it. I've thought about trying it out, and I've definitely thought about trying to piece together, you know, at least some kind of a representative mixed culture using some microbes from West African beer, from Beninese beer, to try something at home. I mean, it's hard to find malted sorghum. You can buy sorghum malt extract homebrew shops, but I haven't. Yeah, I don't know of anyone who has actively done it.
Yeah, it would be tricky.
But I bet someone has.
I mean, you know, with the growth of gluten-free ingredients and the availability there, you know, finding the grain, you know, might not be your hardest challenge. I think your hardest challenge would be to build up a culture, a community of microorganisms that would mimic, you know, what you experienced over there.
Yeah, I think you would need to go get some from over there. is the trick. Although maybe using like a Kvike strain with, you know, maybe not. I'd probably have to use a little bit of barley, or just a lactic acid bacteria starter. You know, use some good belly or something to build up a sour chunk of wort and pitch that into a sorghum beer.
Yeah.
And then boil it when it tastes good, and then pitch some sack and maybe blend some vinegar into it. I don't know, but it's possible. I've been thinking for a couple months now about how I might emulate that. I just have so many other brewing projects going on that it's hard to make space and time to do something where I know I'm going to fail pretty epically for a while before anything drinkable comes out of it. You know?
Well, you're in good company there with the DC homebrewers, because you know, they seem to be a pretty sharp group. So you've got some good resources around you.
That's true. And we do have some really talented sour brewers as well in the group.
Well, Ryan, keep us posted, and you know, I do hope that you try to you know, duplicate what you experienced, and it would be fun to taste it if you did.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. I will say that the beer itself, the original stuff, it's not stable, and that's a big problem over there. You know, people are always talking about, well, if we could just stabilize this, if we could just pasteurize it and put it in bottles and sell it, you know, it'd be great. We could make so much more money off of this product and keep it longer. And that's true. So I don't know, maybe using our local, you know, the tools that we have to sanitize it and kind of stop it when it tastes good. I could, you know, I could maybe carb some up or bottle some, and it might be all right.
But then that's part of the charm that's gone.
Yeah, it's true.
The authenticity is gone. It's you know, you're literally trying to capture something in a bottle that you know, that is something live and you know, the surroundings has got to have a lot to do with it too.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Well, Ryan, this has been fun. I'm glad that you got back in touch with us or with me, and I'm glad that you're feeling better than the last time I talked to you.
Yeah, a lot better. So.
And welcome back to the USA.
I appreciate it.
Well, thanks again to Ryan. I had forgotten that he was in the hospital when we last talked. I'm glad he's feeling better this time. And I hope he tries to make Chukatu himself. I have a feeling that we'd have to go to him to try it. And then we could, but if we do, we could stop at Sapwood Cellars there in the D.C. area. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.